from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I want to punch you in the face so bad right now.
This is the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Get the governor a harumph.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Today's episode is brought to you by Advantage Multi from Bayer. Advantage Multi is veterinarians' number one choice in the prevention of heartworms, fleas, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms. Treats and controls sarcoptic mange. Make sure your dog is protected by using Advantage Multi.
I said what I said and I'll stand by it to the death.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
And now, here are your hosts, J. Paul Jackson.
You just love to hear yourself talk, don't you? Even when you're not saying anything.
Rocky LaFleur.
Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Houston Kennedy.
Please, Houston, we have a problem.
And Josh Webb.
Coons! Well, raccoon's trying to get on our back porch. Mama just chased him off with a broom.
Welcome to the On Next podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com. I'm your host, J. Paul Jackson, and today I will be joined by, of course, the illustrious Rocky LaFleur, and we have a special guest host, Mr. Joe Robison of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Now, of course, Rocky, I guess you're there in the Morgan City studios, is that right?
I am. I'm at the Duck South studios in Morgan City.
Man, I'm driving south on I-75. Just a few minutes ago, I left the Point Mulier Waterfowl Festival, and I tell you, it's a great waterfowl festival. A lot of duck hunters from the northern part of the Mississippi Flyway were there, and I also got to spend some time with my buddy Joe Robison of the Michigan DNR, who's with us here today. And Joe is, of course, a wildlife biologist. He works in a lot of different facets with the state of Michigan, but he also is a very dedicated waterfowler and has done some great work through the Michigan DNR for waterfowling opportunities, not only at Point Mulier, but at other places all throughout Michigan. And Joe, man, we're really, really honored to have you with us today as our guest. Welcome to the podcast.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on the podcast and speak some duck language with you. And it's great seeing you this weekend at the 69th annual Point Mulier Waterfowl Festival. We had a little washout yesterday, but pretty good, great weather today and pretty good turnout. So hopefully you enjoyed yourself up here in the northern climate.
Oh, man, I had a blast. I mean, I tell you, for you guys in the south where we come from, if you get the trip, if you haven't made the trip, it needs to be on everybody's bucket list to come to this part of Michigan and experience it. I mean, there are a lot of great things here. Of course, the Waterfowl Festival. It's held at Point Mulier State Wildlife Management Area, where you're based out of, Joe, of course. And 3 or 4 years ago, I had the privilege of coming up here and going on a diver shoot out of pumpkin seed layout boats on the Detroit River, which is really a sound that connects Lake St. Clair and Lake Erie. And I had a great time with you then, Joe, and you also put me on a great Canada goose hunt. And just an area that is steeped in waterfowling tradition. So, yeah, I had a blast, man. I can't wait to come back next year.
You need to come back this year. Yeah, you need to come back this year. We definitely had a great week of hunting. Michigan, definitely has a lot of diversity to offer, from, marsh shooting. We do a lot of flooded crops that are managed waterfowl areas. We call them the gems of the Midwest, where we hold drawings every day for hunters to go out in different zones and hunt. We intensively manage these areas for waterfowl and waterfowl production. They hold thousands of ducks, in the fall in the refuges, the crop refuges. And there's also crop fields where hunters can come in and choose some of those zones, or natural marshes, all that stuff, from hunting the rivers, hunting the backwaters, the diver hunting out on Lake Erie, Lake St. Clair, Saginaw Bay, the Chesapeake of the Midwest. There's just tremendous amount of diversity here in Michigan. A lot of folks, don't realize that Michigan usually ranks the top 3 in Canada goose harvest across the nation. We're usually in the top 5 to 9 states for duck harvest. So we do have a lot of waterfowl. It's rich in tradition, a lot of waterfowl hunting opportunities that are only unique to this area.
And to put that in perspective, Michigan's in the top 10 in duck states in the nation. Did I understand you correctly?
That's correct.
Yeah. So yep. I know Rocky's got several questions for you, and we've got a couple also from our DuckSouth.com website. But I want to ask you first, so let's say that a guy like me or Rocky or one of our members here at DuckSouth.com on our forums wants to come up and hunt. I know that you operate a draw every day there at Point Mouillet, but are there other opportunities for non-residents to come up and not have to worry about going through a draw? I mean, what's the public hunting like, and what are the public hunt opportunities, both just walk in and by a draw?
So we have a lot of just open areas. Like here at Point Mouillet, it's 4,040 acres. It's one of the largest freshwater marsh restoration projects in North America. Portions of Point Mouillet, we do have managed hunting here. We hunt 2.5 days a week here. We hunt a Tuesday morning, a Thursday morning and afternoon, and then Sunday morning and afternoon. But then we also have areas like the Humphreys unit or the Vermette unit, the Bad Creek unit. Those areas are open 7 days a week, first come, first serve. There's all kinds of islands in the Detroit River. There's Erie State Game Area right on the Michigan-Ohio line. There's Point of Pole Wildlife Area. We have St. John's Marsh up on Lake St. Clair. That's all open. And there's all kinds of coastal wetlands that are state game areas up on Saginaw Bay. There's inland state game areas. We have a lot of public land. We're fortunate to, here in Michigan, we do have a lot of public land, a lot of opportunities for open hunting. If they do want to come to one of these draws at one of the seven managed areas we have here in Michigan, we have 5 in Southeast Michigan, we have 2 in Southwest Michigan, and there's a lot of information on the DNR's website. We have videos that showcase each of the areas, how they go through a draw, what they can expect at each area, what type of equipment they need. Very, very good videos of showing what each area is about, what they need to hunt these areas. We also have fact sheets. Every week, starting in the middle of September, all of our managers at each of these managed waterfowl areas, they produce a weekly report, a weekly manager's report, where they talk about how, the number of ducks, what the conditions are of the area, some of the better areas to hunt, what type of ducks we have. That's done every week all the way to the end of duck season. So that's another good resource for hunters. If they're looking to come to Michigan, they can look and see when the ducks are here. We publish that on a weekly basis on the DNR website.
Joe, I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to jump away from the duck hunting because, the thing that I've learned about Michigan is Michigan's a lot like the state of Alabama. There are loyalties that are there. So before I get into my duck questions, I have to ask you, are you a Spartan or are you a Wolverine?
I bleed blue and gold.
Okay. I had to ask that question because.
So what does that mean? Is he a Spartan or a Wolverine?
Wolverine.
No, he's blue. A Wolverine. He's a Wolverine, man. Look, I'm joking.
Michigan State's colors are like orange and red, aren't they, or something? Or green and white?
White and green. Green and white.
Yeah,
green and white. All right.
Yeah, Jay Paul doesn't like that. This, but I really like Alabama, too. Because I was rooting for Michigan all those years, and he had a losing program, and. It seemed like Alabama never lost, so I rooted for him. I was always happy the next day.
Oh, I'm so glad the fat boy couldn't be with us today. He would be giving us hell over that, let me tell you.
Oh, I don't know. You know, that 22 point. What was the last text that he sent out to the whole group? Alabama was going to win by 22. And I'm not claiming a moral victory here, but 22
no,
points.
No, did you see
oh,
what I
goodness.
Said? Look. For the listeners and for Joe, this is kind of an inside joke. So Rocky and I are Ole Miss fans, and Houston Kennedy, our co-host, is a big Roll Tide fan. And yesterday he was sending a group text, and Josh, of course, lives in Mississippi, so he's not a big Alabama fan either. And so yesterday he was putting these group texts out here saying that Alabama was going to win by 22 or more. And Rocky came back. He said, you know what? All I'm going to say is it's going to be close. It's going to be within 7 points either way. And by the way, Rocky, I hope you noticed that I did send a text to the group saying that you look pretty dang good after the game. You're a pretty good prognosticator. But, hey, Michigan's rolling too. I mean, Harbaugh has that team like a well-oiled machine, doesn't he, Joe?
Yeah, they didn't play too good in the first half yesterday, but the second half they really stepped up and pulled the victory out. So
I think they'll be in the college football playoff this year. I'm predicting it right now. Michigan will be in the – they will beat Ohio State and be in the playoff.
I sure hope so. Living so close to the border, you got a lot of those Buckeye fans.
All right, let me get back to the duck questions. J-Paul really opened us up with a great question because, you know, a lot of the people that are listening to this podcast are going to be from the South and, you know, are going to be travelers to your state, Joe. So I'm going to open up with a easy underhand softball to you. Now, mm-hmm. if I'm traveling to Michigan, you know, most of the ducks that we kill here in Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, you know, are mallards, pintails, teal, shovelers. What unique opportunities, if I wanted to go to Michigan, could I have to, you know, what other type of duck that I wouldn't kill here could I kill there?
Well, we have a lot of divers that come through here, a lot of goldeneye, a lot of bufflehead, canvasbacks, redheads, bluebills. And the thing that's really turned on the last couple of years up on Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, is the long-tail ducks. Yeah, I mean, they're shooting limits of long-tails on the Lake Huron up towards Saginaw Bay and over to Muskegon, Grand Haven area, hunting out of big boats with a couple lines of decoys. That's really unique. That's really changed here in Michigan. We're seeing a lot more scoters and a lot more long-tail ducks because of the zebra mussel population. They've really adapted to that, and they're here pretty much all the way through December.
I just wanted to clarify, when you say long tail, you're talking about an old squaw, right?
Yeah, we're not allowed to say old squaw anymore. You got to say long tail.
Beg your pardon?
They make us say long tail ducks. We're not allowed to say old squaw anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did not know that. Okay, well, I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. A lot of people still call them old squaw, so no big deal.
Yeah, and we actually were talking about earlier this week with Sean and Nico. Rocky, you actually got to kill a long tail while we were out in Utah a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it is a very unique duck that if you don't step out of the South, you'll never see or, you know, have the opportunity to get one. So, that's pretty unique.
Yeah, and Joe, I'm sorry, I just walked all over your thread. So go ahead and finish what you were saying about the long tails.
No, that's fine. The other thing that's unique is that these state-run areas, you know, we're farming, like at Hartson's Island, we're farming 800 to 900 acres of crops at that area. It's a 3,600-acre complex. And at Point Loyer, we're farming around 300 acres of, you know, corn, buckwheat, millet. And we also do moist soil impoundments like you guys do a lot down south down there. But I get a lot of hunters that come up from Mississippi or Missouri, and they're like, I can't believe you do this for your waterfowl hunters. You know, down there, it's a $1,000 duck club or $5,000 or $10,000 you would pay for a lease. And a lot of guys are surprised about how well and how intensively we manage these areas for our waterfowl hunters that come up here and enjoy it.
Yeah, and as you were saying earlier, too, two things here. Number one, I want to ask you about when does it open, because there are a lot of guys in our part of the world that would really like to be shooting ducks in the near future, and it's going to be after Thanksgiving at the earliest for most of us. So when's the duck hunting opportunities open for non-residents there?
Residents and non-residents open at the same time. We just had a 7-day early teal season, September 1st to the 7th. We have an early goose season going on right now, September 1st to the 25th. And I'm talking, this is all southern Michigan. We have 5 a day the whole month of September, and then our duck season in the southern zone opens October 8th, runs for 58 days, and then there's a 2-day split over New Year's Eve, and then we have a late goose season that runs January, February, where you're allowed 3 a day. There's a lot of opportunities. Then we also have a UP zone that opens up last Saturday in September, which would be September 24th, and then our northern lower zone opens October 1st, and then down here it opens October 8th. So we have 3 duck zones. We have a split in each zone. They could come up and start hunting in September and hunt for a couple weeks and work down to hit all 3 openers or hit 2 of the openers. So there's a lot of opportunity. We try to maximize our number of days by having those 3 zones and 1 split in each zone.
And also, you were saying earlier that you do a lot of things up there for the public hunters. So a guy coming up from Tennessee or Mississippi, Louisiana, he doesn't have to go totally blind. You guys have weekly reports, and if a guy comes up, he can take advantage of that and have an opportunity to go out and hunt with a little bit of knowledge under his belt. What would you suggest for someone to maximize that opportunity to do if he were coming up from Mississippi here next Saturday for your first opener?
I'll call ahead and talk to you. You know, there's a list of DNR employees, Wildlife Division employees, and if they find an area that they want to hunt, there's a geographic listing of which biologist covers what area. You know, call that biologist and talk to them, and just have a bunch of questions ready for them and ask them what they need, where they need to go, where the ducks are, what they're seeing. You know, just do your homework. All my managers are more than happy to talk to people anytime, direct them in the right direction. And we want people to come up and be successful and have a good time. That's what our job is. You know, we try to accommodate the hunters, try to give them as much information as we can. Like you said, there's a lot of info on our DNR website. It has all the state game area maps, what's open to public hunting, where the draws are. So a lot of good information on our website. But I'd also make that one-on-one contact with the area manager, which let's say you go to the website, it tells you who's managing that area and give him or her a call, and they're more than happy to talk with you and fill you in on all the great information that we have available.
Hey, Joe, let me ask you a quick question. You were talking about teal season just a minute ago. How was teal season in Michigan this year?
It was a little better than last year. We're under a three-year experiment. We were considered a production state. So we haven't had teal hunting here since the late 60s, early 70s. And we combined forces with Wisconsin and Iowa and Michigan. We went to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and said we would like to try teal hunting again. So the last 3 years, we have to meet this minimum requirement of hunters where our DNR employees, we go out and we do spy blinds. We're sitting out in the marsh observing hunters and making sure they weren't shooting at non-target species. And this year was really, really good in Michigan, but it's a combined three-state effort, so all of us have to have, I believe it's a 10% or less non-target attempt at non-teal. So this year we did 16 teal observations just in southeast Michigan here, and we had not one non-target. So hopefully that season can become operational, and we can see it into the future as long as the teal population is above the goal that they need.
Yeah. Yesterday, you and I were having lunch together, and we've asked other people along the way. We talked with Ramsey Russell of GetDucks.com last week, who's a biologist also and kind of an expert. And I posed this question to you. We had a 22% drop from last year to this year, according to the May pond counts in the teal population. But we're still well above the long-term average. But what is your first reaction to that 22%, almost 2 million bird decline from 8.5 million to 6.7 million, according to the counts?
For me, I do fly annual waterfowl surveys here in Michigan. I've been flying them since 1995. I started when I was like 10 years old. No, that's a joke. But when you fly these surveys, sometimes you're not counting all the birds. So it's really hard to gauge. It's an index of the population. It's not a total account, but it's an index. It gives you a gauge of what the population is, what it looks like. So it's not a total count. Some years you're going to count, most of the birds get a good count. Some years the survey timing might be a little off, or it's too early or too late. You try to time it about the same time every year with leaf foliage and timing of migration, make sure they're pair bonded, some ducks are on the nest. So there's some method to the madness. You know, there's science behind it, but sometimes just the count might be off a little bit because you're not counting everything. The birds have shifted somewhere else. So those are some of the factors that could contribute to that. The visibility on flying the survey, there's a lot of things that could account for, a drop in population like that.
Cool. Man, it's really good to hear you say that, because a lot of people, you just gave a lot of credibility to the way that the counts occur and to what U.S. Fish and Wildlife and what the state agencies are doing. We hear a lot of people, talk about, those numbers aren't accurate. I didn't see those numbers of birds. They're way overestimating them or whatever. But the reality of the situation is we may not see birds in the south because they may not migrate the same corridor. That doesn't mean that, there aren't a whole ton of birds. And also, this counting is obviously not an exact science. We've heard a lot of people comment, some with dismay that, hey, wait, they're going to set the framework for the seasons this year before the count goes out every year. But, while the count is a good indicator, it appears to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears to me that it is something that you have to take and average in with a lot of other things. And you can't just take one single year and say, hey, this is fact. but instead you kind of balance it over several years and weigh in other factors too. Would that be accurate, Joe?
Yeah, that's very accurate. It's there's no way you can go from year to year. And there's always that, you know, not argument, but discussion about whether hunters are, you know, added to the mortality or compensatory. And most scientists, most biologists believe it's compensatory. You know, they really don't have an effect on the population for most species, not all species, but most species like mallards and teal and, you know, some of the species that have lower population numbers. Sure, we can shoot too many, and that's why there's smaller restrictions on some of them. And the way most hunters target mallards and, you know, those species, and it's just there is science behind the madness is what I'm saying. But I've been flying these, like I said, these waterfowl surveys since 1995 here in Michigan, and yeah. I can tell you firsthand, some years I feel really good about it. Some years the visibility is not as good. If the sun's shining or you got different factors in there, the timing, but it's just a good index to look at across a long period of time. That's not good to look at it from year to year. And what happens here in Michigan is they read these numbers that are being produced by Ducks Unlimited and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service saying record fall flight. And what's happened here in Michigan is people don't realize that 75% of the mallard shot here in Michigan, based on band recoveries, and we ban 5,000-6,000 mallards here a year in Michigan, Minnesota, every state bans ducks, you know, wood ducks, mallards, whatever it may be, and they ban up in Canada. But based on band recovery data, we know that 75% of the mallards being shot are from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And that wasn't the case back in the 90s and even until the early 2000s. That has changed. And the reason that changed is you had a transverse relationship in habitat conditions. In Prairie Canada, they used to produce millions of mallards. And now Prairie U.S. several years ago surpassed Prairie Canada producing mallards. We produce more mallards in Prairie U.S. than Canada. And a lot of those ducks are being produced in North and South Dakota and Montana and Minnesota. And those ducks really have a southerly migration. That's why you hear a lot of people going out to Nebraska and Oklahoma and Kansas and having great hunts out there. Because even South Dakota, you know, it's phenomenal out there. I was out in Nebraska a couple of years ago, and I've never seen so many mallards. And so in Michigan, we went from, it was about 56% originated from the Great Lakes region in southern Ontario back in the 90s and early 2000s. And we used to get a lot of those ducks being produced in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. Well, a lot of those mallards are now being produced in North and South Dakota. And they go straight south, and we don't really see a lot of those mallards coming from that area. We do see the bluebill and the redheads because they come across Michigan and head to the East Coast for the winter. So that's something to keep in mind, too. When you start looking to travel states, kind of get an idea where their ducks are coming from. Like here in Michigan, we had a pretty stable population. It's pretty similar. Our estimated population of mallards is pretty similar to last year. So we should have a decent fall as long as Mother Nature cooperates.
Hey, Joe, I know that you've got to get away from here because you're taking your daughter or you're going hunting this afternoon. But look, I've got one more question for you. And it's the one that I came into the show with, but one thing that Michigan needs a round of applause for is what you guys are doing with the youth hunting. And that's the mentored youth hunting that I read about online. Can you talk about that a little bit before you have to go?
Yeah, we allow all the, you know, 9 and under kids, if they want to try hunting, they can go under a mentor, a licensed hunter that's 21 years of age or older. They can go out and hunt and buy this cheap mentor license and try it out. And it gives them opportunity to get kids a field and allows people, you know, take kids out, get them out in the outdoors, get them away from the video games. You know, I always say a family that hunts together stays together. So that's always something I strive in and trying to accomplish is getting kids involved. Every year we have annual youth hunts here at all of our managed waterfowlers in Southeast. Just this past couple weeks ago, we had a youth hunt here at Point Lee. We had 40-some kids come. They were all this hunt was sponsored by Waterfowl USA, Southwestern Lake Erie Chapter, and Gibraltar Duck Hunters Association. What they did is every kid got a dozen duck decoys, every kid got a duck and goose call, they got a lanyard, they got Rig and Wright sent us hats to give out to the kids. Tony Packles, a local restaurant at Toledo, provided all the lunch for the kids. We had guides take them out in the morning, they hunted, and then we convened here at Point Lee State Gamer headquarters and gave them all those prizes and then fed them lunch and we gave them some calling seminars and how to set decoys. And then each kid got a prize off the raffle table. We've been doing that for about 14 years here. So the take-home message is, I get this a lot, well, not all kids are going to hunt. Yeah, you're right. Not all kids are going to hunt. But if you introduce them to hunting and they go through it, they understand, they shoot a few ducks, maybe down the road, they don't take up hunting because they get busy with life, they get married, they go to college, whatever it may be. But that's always going to be in their back of their mind, because we're always going to have people coming at us saying hunting's barbaric, want to take away your hunting rights. Anytime we can take somebody out, show them that hunting is a legitimate, you know, sport, that it's awesome to spend time with family, friends, harvest those animals, take them home, feed your family, have wild game dinners, whatever. Show them that we're eating what we're shooting. Yeah, I love duck and goose. I've been hunting for, I think it's my 34th year. That's one of my favorite things, is introducing new people, whether it's an adult or a kid, whoever it may be, and then showing them how to cook it properly, how to eat it. That's a great thing. And teaching them that hunters are the conservationists. We've been the conservationists for the 20th and 21st century. If it wasn't for hunters, you wouldn't see a lot of the populations, the bald eagle come back, the osprey come back, the peregrine falcons here in Michigan, the white-tailed deer, the wild turkey, the Canada goose. Canada geese were almost extinct in Michigan, or they were thought to be extinct, but they're using hunter license dollars. We've been able to restore wetlands. We've been able to build some impoundments. We've been able to do a lot of habitat work across Michigan to bring back wild turkeys, to bring back the deer population, Canada goose population. Wood duck is another prime example. Without hunters' money, we would never been able to do that, because the Michigan DNR is funded, majority of it's funded by the PR Fund, the Pittman-Robertson Fund, which is, an excise tax on ammunition firearms that the federal government gives back to each state, but also the hunting licenses. When somebody buys a hunting license or fishing or trapping license, it all comes back, and that's how we manage all the state land. That's how we manage different wildlife populations. That's how we do these youth hunts and all the other stuff associated with our management.
Joe, like I said at the beginning of the question, I mean, what you guys are doing there in Michigan with getting youth involved as a state program, I mean, you guys deserve a round of applause, man. I appreciate what you're doing, because it seems like we're having less and less fathers getting involved teaching and taking kids hunting. So you guys deserve a round of applause. I appreciate you coming on the show today. You've given a lot of information. I just want to thank you for coming on here with us.
I appreciate the opportunity, and safe travels, Jay Paul. I'm going to take my daughter out deer hunting. We got a youth deer hunt this weekend up here in Michigan, and I'm going to get her back out in the woods tonight.
Yes, sir. I know you're anxious. Speaking of taking kids hunting, there you go. You and Sydney heading out to the deer stand, brother. It was great to see you this weekend there, and send me a picture of that deer when she pops one tonight. I hope you have a very successful hunt and get to spend some quality time with Sydney. Appreciate you letting us dig into that. You have a great evening.
You too. Thanks. Make sure you get up here this fall.
I will, buddy. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
I'll see you guys. Bye.
All right, folks. That was my good friend Joe Robinson from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. And this first half of our podcast today has been brought to you by Bayer Animal Health, makers of Advantage Multi, the only heartworm preventative that is 100% effective in the prevention of heartworms in the Mississippi Flyway. Bayer Advantage Multi. Hey, Rocky Man, I'll tell you, we've had some really good guests, but when it comes to knowledge and guys who are willing to call it like they see it, I don't think we've ever had anybody better than Joe. What do you think?
Well, him and Ramsey, they have definitely tipped the scales. For sure. They're not going to be politically correct in any of their answers. I mean, they both just told it how it is.
Hey, and talking about politically correct, did that not shock you when he said that they're not allowed? Of course, remember, he's a state employee. And apparently in the state of Michigan, because it's offensive to somebody, an old squaw is apparently not a politically correct term. Did it not shock you, though, to hear him say that they're not allowed to call them that they now call them long tails instead of old squaw?
Can you explain that to me? I mean, what's so incorrect about saying old squaw?
You know, all that I can think is that old squaw being, I don't even know if it would be a slang term, but a term for a Native American woman, maybe, that was offensive to the Native American population, possibly.
Wow.
I'm going to definitely have to get some clarification on that. And, again, it's about geographic reasons, and I'm not making any type of determination on that or certainly not wanting to make any kind of remark that could be taken as off color, because, I mean, it varies. I mean, you've got the Seminole Nation in Florida that, you know, they are very, very, very proud that Florida State University has the Seminole as their mascot. But then you have, you know, people who are very offended that, you know, Washington's football team is the Redskins. So you never know, but that would be my take and guess on that. But still, man, I was just like, what? You got to call him Longtail now?
Dude,
I know we talk about this guys every week. Yeah, crazy.
Oh my gosh. But don't get me started, because I'll tell you a little bit later after the podcast what happened at the game yesterday. So let me go ahead and ask you the dog training tip of the week question. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready, brother.
All right, a Duck South user. Him and his friend were having an argument at, I guess they were having a cleanup this weekend at maybe deer camp or duck camp. And one friend mm-hmm. said it was okay for him, if a dummy was not present, for him to throw sticks for his dog. What do you have to say about that? Is it good? Is it bad? What
you mean? You mean like playing with them?
Yeah, fetch. Just play them.
You
fetch.
Mean just like pick up a stick and let's play fetch. Oh
yeah.
Man, I have no problem with that at all. Look, I've got dogs that I'm trying to think. Historically, there was a national champion. I believe it was River Oaks Corky or one of his progeny. That was a national field trial champion, and his owner would hide dimes around the house in the living room, and that dog would go around and it would find them, and it would actually pick the dimes up and bring them back to his owner. And it was a little game they played, and this dog won a national championship. So I throw whatever's handy sometimes, you know. I mean, Rain, my current retriever, her mother, Ella, who is now going into retirement. But when she runs out in the yard, if she can't find a dummy, she's going to come back with the biggest stick she can find. She's going to come back with a pine cone. She's going to come back with something that she wants you to throw, because that retrieve desire is just so strong in that dog. And she wants to retrieve. And I think that maybe part of the reason that retrieve desire is so strong is because, you know, with our puppies, hey, whether it's a puppy dummy, a regular dummy, a teal, a Dachshund, a pine cone, you know, whatever we could find to get them crazy about retrieving. Or we start with rolled up socks, with leather gloves sometimes with dogs, you know, whatever tool we could find for them to retrieve. I think the important thing that you need to remember here is it's not the tool that you're using, it's what you're teaching that dog, and it's all about building up the desire to retrieve. And if that dog's force-fetched, it's all about proper delivery. You know, if you've got your dog force-fetched and you make sure that that dog always delivers to hand a dummy, then you need to do the same exact dead-gum thing with a stick. But I don't know, you know, what the argument was there. But I would definitely say, if there was one guy saying, hey, man, I throw my dog a stick if I don't have a dummy present, and his buddy was saying, oh, no, you can't do that.
I think it was
I'd
for health reasons.
I'd call BS on that.
Maybe dental or digestive reasons, maybe?
Well, you know, I mean, again, it's a dog. They'll eat just about anything. You know, I've seen dogs eat grass, strip bark off trees, whatever. You know, I mean, hey, you know, they pick up and eat dead things you and I wouldn't touch. Listen, there, you know, here's a really good point for me to bring in here right now. The worst thing that you can ever do is let your dog have a cooked chicken bone, or any type of cooked bone is bad, because they become very, very brittle and they break off. And you know, they can. I know of a dog, personal experience, not hearsay, personal experience. Several years ago, I know a dog that the owners came in one Sunday from church with a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that dog got in that bucket of chicken and ate it all. And 3 days later, it was dead, where those chicken bones had perforated its intestine. So, yeah, I mean, there are things that dogs can eat that are very dangerous to them. Chocolate, it's not good for your dog. But, you know, chewing up a stick, I'm not really worried about that either. I mean, I would say, hey, play fetch with your dog with whatever you can do. Just make sure that you have the same rules no matter what that dog's retrieving. And, you know, do anything you can to build up that dog's retrieve desire. Because if you've got a dog that really, really loves to retrieve, then you've always got that to fall back on for fun when you're doing advanced training. And I hope that's helped.
Now, this part of the broadcast has been brought to you by Training with J-Paul. Training with J-Paul is a website that will help you improve your dog's retrieving techniques at home. Now, J-Paul has a lot of written content and video content on the site for you to look at to help make your retriever better. Also, there's a portion on the website called Ask J-Paul. Just hit that, click the button, ask J-Paul a question, usually 24, 48 hours, maybe not right now because he's on the road. But usually he'll respond back to you pretty promptly with an answer and usually in a video of how to correct whatever your question may be. And look, all people that listen to On the X podcast or are a member of Duck South, you can use the discount code On the X and receive 1 month free. That's trainingwithjpaul.com and just put in the discount code On the X. You know, J-Paul, you brought up a great point just a second ago when you were talking about what to and what not to feed a dog. And look, I've been married to a vet now for 12 years. And, you know, it still surprises me that so many people don't know to not feed their dogs bones. I see so many people just throwing bones and throwing scraps out the back door like we used to when we were kids. You remember how mom and dad were with animals?
Oh yeah.
Dogs didn't live to be but 5 or 6 years old anyway because of heartworms, and there wasn't any kind of preventative. So you fed them anything. You just let the dog be happy. But now dogs are living to be 10, 15 years old, and you know, once a dog really gets up to that upper age limit, you know, that say 10 years old, a case of pancreatitis, which most of the time is what you're looking at when you feed a dog scraps, can kill a dog really fast.
Sure.
And I hear about it and see so many people having to bring in their animals on emergencies to my wife because, well, when she was in Greenville, I used to have to drive and sit with a pistol in the truck while she looked over the dog. But, you know, I see a lot of cases where people are still feeding scraps just right out the back door to their dog or whatever and having these cases of pancreatitis. And chocolate, chocolate, you really got into it when you said chocolate. A ton of people don't know that you're not supposed to feed dogs chocolate or grapes. Grapes is another one. That you don't feed them that because, you know, you can shut the liver down. But, I know you could talk about this all day.
Well, hey, but while you brought it up, let me comment on a couple things. I want to comment on three things right quick because you just hit on them. And I want to lead into it with this, so I guess it's four things. My first comment, you just talked about our dogs not living very long. You know, when I was a kid, we never dreamed of keeping a dog in a kennel or restrained. Just about every dog that I had growing up as a child was buried in my backyard after it was hit by a car because, you know, we very irresponsibly, different time, different generation, let our dogs just run. And, you know, we were in a rural area, but eventually they were going to get near the highway. Thankfully, as a rule, you know, today most people, I mean, we definitely keep all of our dogs in the kennel. Even my house dogs, they go out in the yard. They are never unattended, ever, not for 1 minute. You know, what's crazy is you could have a dead-gum mongrel as a pet, and it can live for 10 years going back and forth across the highway in front of your house and never be hit by a car. But if you've got a hunting retriever champion or master hunter, Labrador retriever, I guarantee you, you let it out for 2 hours unattended, and you're going to find it on the side of the road. You know, I mean, that's just, I don't know why that is, but my gosh. But we do have dogs living much longer. So I'd like to address three things really quick. Number one, we are brought to you by Advantage Multi. A lot of people do not know that the heartworm has mutated. This is a fact. There have been a couple of published clinical studies done. The biggest one at Auburn University, Dr. Byron Blackburn, that proved that not all heartworm preventives are 100% effective anymore. So, you know, I think it's very important that you have your dog on the right preventative. We use Advantage Multi. Telling that not to plug the brand, but just as a statement of fact. Number two, bones. Yeah, you know, any type of cooked bone, if you throw it out in the yard, even if you throw it someplace where your dog can't get to it, you are endangering any other dog that might come along. Different between raw. That raw ham bone that, you know, you might pick up from the butcher and throw out there for your dog, not a big deal. It's not brittle. It's raw. It's never been cooked. But cooked bones are very, very dangerous. And then the third thing, medications. Dogs' livers metabolize drugs very, very differently, and chemicals in general, as you just alluded to, Rocky, talking about grapes, and actually it's a chemical in the skin of the grape. Never, ever, ever give your dog Tylenol, acetaminophen. Aspirin is safe. Tylenol is not. So before you give your dog any type of non-steroid anti-inflammatory, consult with your vet. There are some very, very good ones out there on the market that are very safe for your dog that you can also take. But you want to consult with your vet before just giving your dog something like Tylenol for pain. So those were the three things I wanted to point out there.
And I'm gonna tell you something. One of the things that I learned from listening to these emergency phone calls that Roy Inwood used to get in the middle of the night, or, you know, while we were sitting around the dinner table, there are a lot of things that Pepto Bismol and Karo syrup can heal to an animal.
Amen.
And I'm not recommending those to anybody on this podcast. Consult your vet with anything you may have. But it is amazing how many times that I heard my wife say, look, just put a handful of ice cubes in the dog bowl, let them drink that, or rub Karo syrup on their gums, or just give them a small amount of Pepto-Bismol, or the best one. I think my dog has been stung or bit by something. Small shot of children's Benadryl. Is that right?
Amen. That's right. Dead on. And, you know, that's another thing. Dogs rebound from those kinds of things. I mean, God made them where a snake bite. I cannot tell you how many times I've had a dog bitten by a snake. I've had it happen twice, once with a cottonmouth and once with a rattlesnake during a hunt test or field trial competition. The cottonmouth occurred in Arkansas, outside of Searcy, Arkansas, and the rattlesnake occurred in Montana, up near Great Falls, Montana, a pygmy rattler. Both times, not only did the dog survive, I was able to, both times it happened on a Saturday, and I was able to run the dog in the competition on Sunday the very next day. It's amazing what Benadryl and a big shot of some type of antibiotic, usually amoxicillin or cephalexin, will do to take care of a snake bite or any kind of bite like that in a dog.
Yeah, I never knew about the snake bites until I was married to Roy Ann, about how many dogs get bit by snakes and the next day they're fine. It's unreal. But a better one than that, the most famous one, and looking back on it now, all these emergency calls when Roy Ann owned her own clinic in Greenville, was one of the most famous calls that we always got. And
are we talking famous or strangest? Are we talking famous?
No, it's famous. It's the most common.
I want to hear the strangest after the most famous.
The most common, another one of the most common calls was, oh, is Dr. LaFlorian, I don't know what's going on with my dog. Let me see if you can diagnose this, J. Paul. I want you to try.
Right.
Listen, for people that don't know J. Paul, J. Paul actually probably could take the veterinary, the licensing for the veterinary test and pass it tomorrow. This is how smart this guy
is. No, don't throw that out there.
Listen, when him and my wife get together, it is amazing the things that they talk about, okay? So I'm going to brag on you just a minute, but let me see if you can diagnose this. One of the most common calls that Roy M. would always get was, oh, my dog, it's Dr. LaFleur, and my dog just came in the house, and he's just foaming from the mouth everywhere. I don't know what to do. So if somebody called and said that, what would be your first thought about what happened? What could be causing that dog to salivate and just foam at the mouth?
Well, the first thing that I'd tell them to do is take a look in your dog's mouth and tell me, is there anything that dog could have gotten into that the dog could have eaten, chewed up, that would be giving you that kind of reaction? That's not toxic.
There's something that's common in the South, or pretty much the whole United States, that if a dog picks up, they will just profusely foam at the mouth.
Oh, there's not one. That's why I asked. Take a look at its mouth. I mean, there are several. You know, from different plant life that we have out there, spearmint being one of the main ones, and dogs seem to really love it, to common toad frogs.
Oh, boom! Boom! You got it. You got it. It is the most common thing that will cause a dog to just profusely foam at the mouth. So, listen, all you guys, you should take your dog in if he's foaming at the mouth. But most likely, I can go on and tell you from a lot of emergency phone calls that it was caused by a toad frog. See,
yeah,
I told you guys, J-Paul was smart.
Listen, I've just got a lot of experience. If you live long enough, you're bound to learn some things, and maybe a few of those have stuck over the years. But, you know, it's always a pleasure talking to Roy Ann, too, because your wife is one of the smartest people that I know, and she has been a wealth of information for me also. Well, listen, man, we're fixing to have to go to shut this down, but before we close out, I want your comments. We watched one heck of a game yesterday. Tell me your thoughts on football in the SEC yesterday afternoon.
Now, look, I'm definitely not going to claim a moral victory only losing by four. So when you listen to this, Houston, I'm not claiming that. It was a great game. Both teams made a lot of mistakes, but a lot of people would say yesterday in the Alabama-Ole Miss game that game was decided when the clock struck 0.00. That game was decided in the second quarter. At 2:32, Hugh Freeze thought that he was going to take his foot off the pedal, run the football, run the clock out, go into halftime with a 24-3 lead. Well, his plan didn't work at all. He lost the game right then. And I told my neighbors in the stands, I said, we just lost the ball game. Because in 2:32, Alabama scored 14 points. So we went into halftime 24-17.
This is from the same guy that earlier in the week, we were actually on the telephone and you hung up on me because you were with your family at dinner and Hugh Freeze was walking over to your table to say hi to you. And today you are throwing him under the bus and saying you think Coach Freeze lost that game in the second quarter. Is that right?
No, I just think you made a bad decision. I make bad decisions all the time, but his bad decision affected probably 100,000 people yesterday. So mine doesn't affect, but probably 4 or 5 people when I make a bad one.
Well,
but yeah. I think that's, he did the same thing in the Florida State game. He's done it in big games, but you can't do that. When that quarterback like Alabama has is can run the ball and can score a lot of points fast and the defense is as good as they are, can stop you, you score.
Let me tell you, anybody that doesn't believe that Jalen Hurts is the real deal and is an SEC quarterback, take a look at yesterday's game against Ole Miss and then go back to the season opener against Southern Cal there in Dallas. I mean, He comes in, he turns over the ball on his very first collegiate play, his very first play as a college quarterback, and he rebounds from that and throws and runs for multiple touchdowns in that game to win it. And, you know, in the beginning, they started off trailing by a field goal, and they came back and just trounced them yesterday from a 21-point deficit. They came back. Let me ask you this. What do you think about the play of Chad Kelly? And specifically, his propensity, it appears to me, to turn over the football in critical situations.
Yeah, he had two critical turnovers. They were at the most inopportune moment. Listen, the thing about it is Alabama made critical errors too. Don't get me wrong. Both teams made critical errors at the worst time possible. But when your depth is as strong as Alabama, it's easier to overcome those errors. And it was hot. Oh, my gosh. Second hottest ball game I've ever been at yesterday. It was awful. Here's the worst part about it. Let me tell you how bad it was. Ole Miss ran out of ice, water, the concession stands ran out of everything at the end of the second quarter, going into halftime. They didn't have enough water. And I said, man, this could be a liability for the university. You can't bring in drinks. You can't bring in water on a day like this.
That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Yes, that could. When you've got – how many people –
there were 66,400 people at the game yesterday.
Man, oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, that could turn into a big liability for you when you're not allowing people to bring in, but then, you know, you're running out of retail items to sell to them. Man, that could get bad. I mean, there were people passing out that weren't drunk. They were just dehydrated.
Man, that is crazy. I mean, to think that, when you know with a game of the magnitude of that they're going to run, or you shouldn't even have the potential to run out of ice and water and cold drinks. Like you said, let them bring it in, but even worse in the second quarter. And I'll tell you, I will be very, very anxious tomorrow to hear what our friend Jeffrey and company, what those Exxon has to have to say about that, because I guarantee you it's going to be a hot topic for discussion, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jeffrey and them will definitely be throwing out their opinion on the Rebel Oxford Exxon podcast.
Yeah, I think so, too. And also the apparent inability, whether it's, you know, coaching, inability of the Rebels to take a significant first-half lead and convert. And that's the great thing about football in the SEC. You better watch the game to the end because you never know what's going to happen. And speaking of the end, pretty much out of time here today, but, man, I've had a great time with you. Of course, as always, this podcast on the X Podcast powered by Duck South this week. Today has been brought to you by our friends at Hardcore Brands and Hardcore Decoys, makers of the toughest and most innovative products for waterfowlers that there are today. And I just happened to be by the home office on Thursday. I got to see behind the black curtain at some of the things that we're about to be unveiling this fall for 2017. And man, I mean, the guys at Hardcore, they know it's not easy being hardcore, but they really are going the extra distance to do it. Rocky, I've had a great time today. Before we hang up here, any closing thoughts before we shut her down?
No, I look, Joe is a great guest. I think that he gave a lot of great information. Look, you be careful driving back home. That's a long ways.
Brother, I can't wait to get home to Dixie. It's always nice to go and meet people from across the country. I was really serious about this Waterfowl Festival and about hunting in Michigan. You know, guys, I would encourage, if you want to start your season early, you don't necessarily have to look to going all the way to the Dakotas or Canada to do it. Joe and his colleagues at the Michigan DNR really have done a tremendous job of taking advantage of it personally at providing some great waterfowling opportunities out there. And it's still a long way to duck season in the South, but brother, I can't wait to get there. Once again, man, want to thank everybody. Thank you, Rocky, and hope you've enjoyed this edition of the On Next podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.